Blog Talk Welcome Radio. To Author Chat.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today we are honored to have with us William R. Kelly, a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin, to discuss with us his compelling and important new book, The Future of Crime and Punishment, Smart Policies for Reducing Crime and Saving Money. Welcome, Professor.
Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning to you. What is the future of crime and punishment in America?
Well, if you'd asked me that 6 months ago, I would have had a different answer than I have today, because I think, unfortunately, with the current political campaigns that are going on, we're sort of seeing a resurgence of what we heard in the 1960s from Richard Nixon about crime and fear of crime. I mean, it depends upon the outcome of the election. The future of crime and punishment should be basically a vigorous effort focused on behavioral change, trying to address the reasons that people get involved in crime in the first place. Punishment, as we have done it over the past 50 years, unfortunately, as counterintuitive as it seems, doesn't change behavior sufficiently to reduce recidivism in crime.
You've used the term behavior twice. Isn't behavior a psychological problem? Isn't it a societal problem? How can the criminal justice system cure for the underlying causes of crime?
Well, that is the major question. We have assumed that punishment can alter all of the factors associated with criminal offending, like poverty, like mental illness, like substance abuse, like unemployment. But the bottom line is punishment does nothing to alter those situations and those circumstances and those disorders. As positive and comforting as punishment may be to many individuals, it simply does not accomplish the business of criminal justice, which is presumably to reduce crime and enhance public safety.
You used the term recidivism a few moments ago. What is recidivism and what role does it play in the criminal justice system?
Recidivism is a very common metric for success of criminal justice policies. It's measured in a variety of ways. The most common is probably rearrest. You can also refer to reconviction on a crime, or perhaps even reincarceration. It's sort of the quick and dirty way to determine how well what we're doing works. The thing about recidivism, though, and I mean the official statistics we have today, is that the reoffending of people who've been through the system before is north of 60%. But that's an undercount, because recidivism is an official measure, meaning if these are individuals we've caught. For those we haven't caught, they're not incorporated into that measure. So while we say, you know, that recidivism, if we measure it in terms of rearrest, is about 60 to 65% for those who've been through the system before, we know it's actually higher than that.
Now, are the people who are rearrested for committing new crimes, or are they rearrested for violating the terms of their probation or parole? That is to say, technical issues like not paying a fine or not reporting to a probation or a parole officer?
Really good question. The answer is it's both. Many of them are caught committing a new offense, but many of them also are what is called revoked off of probation or parole. Probation and parole are both community supervision, conditional release from prison if you're on parole, and diversion from prison or jail if you're on probation. In both cases, they're assigned either a parole officer or a probation officer who is in charge of supervising them. And if that officer observes or learns about a violation of one of the conditions imposed on a probationer or a parolee, they have the prerogative of filing a motion to revoke that community supervision. As we've gotten tougher and tougher on crime over the past 45, 50 years, we've seen much more stringent imposition of revocation. It's a tentative policy, and honestly, a lot of probation and parole officers will tell you it's a measure of success. That is, we caught somebody doing something wrong. I would beg to differ. I think it's also at least a measure of the failure to us address the reasons why people get involved in crime. Don't get me wrong. I'm not apologizing for criminal offenders. I'm not saying we should let them all out of jail or prison, and we should all sit in a big circle and sing camp songs. Rather, I think our focus of being tough on crime has been misdirected. As proactive as it sounds, as positive as it sounds, again, punishment, whether it's putting somebody in prison or whether it's imposing more and more conditions on their release from prison or their diversion from prison or jail, is simply not accomplishing what we need to accomplish, which is to enhance public safety.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking with William R. Kelly, a professor of sociology at UT Austin, about his book, The Future of Crime and Punishment, Smart Policies for Reducing Crime and Saving Money. Now, the term in your title, saving money, is interesting. If we followed the plan of your book, that is to say, if we stopped mass incarcerating people and we try to attack the underlying reasons why people commit crime, that is to say, poverty, mental illness, wouldn't that cost more money?
Well, the thing that policymakers often fail to appreciate is that every time somebody reoffends, or if somebody is revoked off of probation or parole, costs are incurred again. So if I'm on probation and I commit a new crime and I'm arrested, what comes into play now are law enforcement costs, jail costs, because I've been now detained in jail, prosecutor costs, court costs, jail costs probably again. So every time somebody reoffends, we're spending that same large amount of money again. And many criminal offenders have very lengthy criminal histories, which means they've been in and out of the system time and time and time again. That is particularly acute for people who have serious substance abuse problems, who are mentally ill. We, for a variety of reasons, use the criminal justice system as a repository for many individuals who are mentally ill, for many individuals who have severe substance abuse problems, who have no business being there. Yes, treatment is expensive, but so is incarceration. So is even supervision on probation. We fail to appreciate the longer-term implications of recidivism in terms of cost. And quite frankly, this was a very deliberate decision to talk about cost because it's hard to get people to agree on what is morally right, what is ethically right in terms of how we deal with people who break the law. Clearly, they do harm, and there need to be consequences for those individuals. But unfortunately, punishment is not the appropriate remedy in most situations. If we go down the path of trying to actually alter individual behavior, clearly, there'll be failures, but in the long run, we will save money.
Several moments ago, you mentioned the fact that many people in the criminal justice system, unfortunately, have long criminal histories. In my mind, one of the most eye-opening chapters in your book was the chapter on the juvenile justice system. Why isn't our juvenile system working? And in particular, I'm concerned about that because, as you point out, the juvenile system is in many respects a pipeline to the adult system. And if we could successfully rehabilitate kids in that system, then we could cut off their access to entering the adult system, and everyone would benefit.
Absolutely. And once again, we're talking about many factors that are much more aggravated at the juvenile justice level. The reason that juvenile justice today is not effective is because we have been, over the past 40 years, transitioning the juvenile justice system into the criminal justice system. We've been tough on crime with adults. We've been also tough on crime with juveniles. It was the same philosophy, you know, that the kids, we punish them, we let them out, and darn it, they do it again. Well, you know, there are good reasons for that, and we have failed to appreciate that we're dealing with a much more acute situation with juveniles. For example, neurodevelopmentally, their brains are not sufficiently developed, especially the frontal lobe of the brain, to impose proper control over their behavior. I mean, if you spend a half an hour learning a bit about neurobiology, it becomes pretty evident why kids get in trouble. And we have used the criminal justice system as a remedy for that. And unfortunately, in most situations, that is precisely the wrong thing to do. Kids are different. And the Supreme Court has even appreciated that. They've handed down several decisions that say kids are neurodevelopmentally different from adults. We should not execute kids. We should not put kids in prison for life without parole because they are different. What we have seen is, as you mentioned, a direct pipeline from the juvenile justice system into the adult system. It is profound. The evidence is clear that treating kids as we treat adults in terms of punishing them not only doesn't work, in many situations, it simply aggravates the problem. So to answer your question, it's really two things. The punishment of the philosophy of punishing kids as we punish adults, and a failure to properly fund intervention rehabilitation programs for kids when they do exist.
As you know, and as many of our listeners may know, I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and I proudly wear it on my sleeve. But I've got to tell you, one part of your book that really made me squirm was your discussion about problem-solving courts and diversion courts and the fact that criminal defense lawyers would basically be part of a team, and along with judges and prosecutors and probation officers, we would be part of a collaborative process and basically abandon our traditional role, our ethically imposed role, as being a zealous advocate within the adversarial system. How do you square your philosophy with our ethical duties as they are currently written?
Well, I don't think they would be abandoned. I mean, I think that would be a key responsibility of defense counsel in those situations. I think the bigger picture here is, what are we trying to accomplish? And clearly due process is an important component of that. But at the end of the day, and now I'm going to anger the other side of the courtroom, at the end of the day, who's ultimately in charge here, at least historically, have been prosecutors. They make essentially all the key decisions regarding the outcomes of criminal cases, especially with regard to plea negotiation. What I'm proposing is that we try and think more creatively, in more of a problem-solving fashion, to figure out on a case-by-case basis what is in the best interest of this individual, what is in the best interest of the community, what is in the best interest of the justice system in terms of resolving this problem that is before us today. We have seen assembly line justice, and I'm sure you can testify to this, on a routine basis. We don't have criminal trials anymore. We have deals made in hallways. We have cases resolved. I mean, due process is a very important issue, but, I mean, for example, criminal intent is a due process issue. It is rarely raised anymore in terms of determining whether or not somebody had intent when they committed a crime. It is, you know, in my experience, it's something that's simply not even a consideration. I appreciate your squirming.
And as you point out in your book, we unfortunately have an epidemic of over-criminalization. That is to say, many, many regulatory offenses have become criminalized, and behavior which 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago was not criminal has become ensconced in the criminal code. We've been talking with William R. Kelly, a professor of sociology at UT Austin, about his book, The Future and Crime and Punishment, Smart Policies for Reducing Crime and Saving Money. Thanks so much, Professor, for joining us here on Author Chats.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to all of my listeners. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere.